The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning, everyone. Interesting to be here at Wisdom House in the summer, as I'm sure some of the other speakers have remarked. I've been here so many times for a winter session when it's dark at 4:30 in the afternoon. I'm sure there have been winter sessions when I've come here and it's been cold and gloomy enough outside that I did not set foot outside the door after I arrived until I left. So now it's long days, summer nights, swimming pool. Completely different experience. My name is Ryoshin. I'm a senior student here. Our study text for this Ango period is the Vimalakirti Sutra. And I have been reflecting on it for the last several weeks. It was written around 100 CE. And like many of the ancient sutras, reading it takes a bit of persistence. It's very stylized writing, and the long catalogs of responses to a particular question get in the way of a modern reader who's used to blog posts, or at least to stories that move the plot forward quickly. I read on my iPhone this online magazine called Medium, where you can select the various things that you're interested in, well-being or computer science or whatever. And each post has a little entry under it. It says something like 5-minute read. Ah, 5-minute read. I don't have time for that now. I want to find a 3-minute read. Well, the Vimalakirti Sutra is not a 3-minute read. I also think that some of us may react to the sutra similar to the way that Manjushri and the other bodhisattvas react when asked to go look in on Vimalakirti, who is in ill health. The testimony is a lot to take in, and it's a lot to take on. I can't be as pure as these bodhisattvas, just as the bodhisattvas think they can't be as pure as Vimalakirti. How quickly we fall into judging mind, comparing mind. I can't give a talk as inspired as the other talks this Ango period, and believe me, I've wrestled with that little sutra there as well, too. Nonetheless, the Vimalakirti Sutra has some wonderful stories. It's filled with humor, tales of supernatural powers, a little bit of gender fluidity, which it makes it very up-to-date. And it expounds many of the principles of Mahayana Buddhism, which are the root of our practice. So it has been an interesting journey for me working with this text, trying to find a way in, trying to find a hook or an angle that is personally relevant to me, such that I can speak from my heart and from my experience in a way that seems worthy of the text. And then early this week, it occurred to me, instead of jumping around or looking for different translations or something like this, or looking for people's commentary, it occurred to me just to go back and start at the beginning, where the world-honored one is asked a question by a rich man's son, whose name is Jeweled Accumulation. Now, in the sutras, the Buddha typically waits until he is asked a question before he speaks. If the role of the teacher is to use expedient means to help us realize ourselves, it's important that they meet us exactly where we are, just as our actions in any situation must be appropriate to the need. So the question that Jeweled Accumulation asks is, how shall we live? or how can we live as bodhisattvas? He doesn't ask the question in exactly this way. In the text, Jeweled Accumulation asks, how can each of the assembled bodhisattvas purify the Buddha lands? How can we purify the Buddha lands? How through our lives can we create a Buddha land or Buddha field? Now that's a worthy question, one that we all struggle with. The Buddha responds that the various kinds of living beings are in themselves the Buddha lands of the bodhisattvas. Why? Now, I love how the Buddha makes a statement, and then he asks a rhetorical why question so that he can go on and answer it. So why are the various kinds of living beings in themselves the Buddha lands of the bodhisattvas? Because it is by inducing the various beings to develop the capacity for bodhisattva practices that they acquire their Buddha lands. It's by inducing the various beings to develop the capacity that a bodhisattva serves. The Buddha then goes on to provide a long list of practices that are part of this cultivation of a Buddha land. Meditation. Having an upright mind. Demonstrating patience. Exercising compassion. Joy. Equanimity. Generosity, keeping the precepts, wisdom, all of the paramitas, all of the elements of the mandala of practice are how we live our lives. They are how we create a Buddha field. Yet when I look at my own mind and my own life, in the world of suffering that we live in and create, it's not always so easy. I was very moved by Joan's experience and evidence that we are all built for compassion. It's in our nervous system. It's in the DNA of species that deviated from us long ago in the evolutionary tree. And I believe it to be true. I've experienced it to be true. But we are also deluded beings, conditioned beings, creatures of habit. We are beings who are subject to the three poisons of the mind, greed, anger, and delusion. When I look at myself, I see these three poisons arise every day. A flash of anger arises. My habitual mind is a greedy mind. The world revolves around me. Some of you may know me. I tend to be a planner. I'll have mapped out what I'm going to get done today and for the rest of the week. And instinctively, I want to shut out the world until I get it done. This kind of mind doesn't always leave space for just being present. It's caused me to miss out on things that are very important. It's caused me to be impatient with myself and with others. Of course, delusion is present in all of this planning. All of these habits are designed to try to control the uncontrollable, to cling to what I like, and to push away what I don't. Now, my planning, my goal setting, my desire for order are an innate part of who I am. One of my grandfathers was a master mechanic. The other was a precision machinist. There you go. My mother was a nurse. I learned about germs at a very, very young age. My father was a teacher. They live on in the qualities that live in me. It makes me feel good to feel like I've accomplished something, as I'm sure it does for most of you. So, my habitual mind is a mind that has allowed me a degree of what the world calls success. And it's also tripped me up big time. This is just one aspect of my habitual mind that I live with every day. Just one aspect. So given my particular bent of habitual mind, which may be different from yours, how can I cultivate a Buddha field? And you can ask yourself the same question. How can I cultivate a Buddha field given my bent of mind? Well, for me, it's a conscious turning towards the light. I plan it. It's a conscious turning towards the light. Actually, I use this metaphor because it's very poetic, but in a Zen sense, it's wrong. It's not actually turning towards the light. As turning towards the light implies that we have a good idea of what is light and what is dark. But as we sink into meditation practice, as we cultivate not knowing, we realize that we have to be very, very careful about categories like right and wrong, good and bad. That's why in Zen we say, it's turning the light inward. It's listening deeply to ourselves and to others without preconceived notions. It's practicing don't know mind. It's bearing witness. And it's taking action that arises from not knowing and from bearing witness. This is part of Bernie's legacy to us, these three tenets of the Zen peacemaker. Compassion is inbuilt, but it has to be cultivated. Wisdom is innate, but it does not manifest without practice. Caring is inbuilt, but I have to give it space to breathe. I have to be present to the moment, not to my goals, but to the moment. To say a few words to the cashier at the supermarket. I have to be present to realize that my significant other needs to talk to me. She will often remind me of things that I should be present to. Hey, let's call my cousin. He had surgery today. It's why we come to Sesshin. It's why we listen to Dharma talks. It's why we read the Vimalakirti Sutra, even when it's difficult. The words of Dogen. Thinking that practice and enlightenment are not one is no more than a view that is outside the Buddha way. In Buddha Dharma, practice and enlightenment are one and the same. Because it is the practice of enlightenment, a beginner's wholehearted practice of the way is exactly the totality of original enlightenment. For this reason, in conveying the essential attitude for practice, it is taught not to wait for enlightenment outside practice. The essential attitude for practice is not to wait for enlightenment outside of practice. And to take a drink. Still, you may have doubts. So the personification of our doubts in the Vimalakirti Sutra is Shariputra. Shariputra thought to himself, if the mind of a bodhisattva is pure, then his Buddha land will be pure, or their Buddha land will be pure. Now, when our world-honored one first determined to become a bodhisattva, surely his intentions were pure Why then is this Buddha land so filled with impurities? Why indeed? When I look at the world, I see the consequences of these poisons every day. Parents separated from children by our government. I heard a quote the other day that said, under Obama, deportation was a cold government performing a necessary act. Under Trump, deportation is a cruel government performing an unnecessary act. I saw an infographic earlier this week about the shootings by the number of mass shootings that we've had in this country since Sandy Hook in 2012. So you may remember on December 4th of 2012, a gunman walked into Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, probably not that far from here, and killed 20 children, 6 adults, and himself. And according to this infographic, since then, we have allowed 2,179 mass shootings to take place in this country. 2,179. The infographic goes on to say, and I really don't know if these numbers are true, although I assume that they are, but of course mass shootings are only a tiny, tiny fraction of the death by gun, something like 2%. The statistics that stated there are that in 2016, there were 39,000 gun-related deaths in this country. 14,000 of them were homicides. 23,000 of them were suicides. So when I thought about including these issues in my talk, I almost took them out. How can I possibly provide a positive message in light of these facts? I can't. Sometimes all we can do is bear witness. Sometimes all we can do is hold the magnitude of the suffering, even for a moment. If we know someone who's affected, we can be there for them. And of course, we can and should. We can raise our voices. We can campaign for those who champion change. We can even write checks. I know that people put down people who write checks, but good candidates, good causes depend on those $25 checks. So go out and write checks, okay? It's important. Every little action matters. So how does the Buddha respond to Shariputra? The Buddha, knowing his thoughts, said to him, "What do you think? Are the sun and the moon impure? Is that why the blind man fails to see them?" "No, Shariputra, it is the failings of living beings that prevent them from seeing the marvelous purity of the Buddha. This land of mine is pure, but you fail to see it." We fail to see that we create a Buddha land right in the midst of our everyday life. There is no Buddha land that is outside of our life. There is no Buddha action that we don't perform. It's up to us. How can we see it? It takes a conscious decision to bring ourselves to the cushion. It takes a conscious effort to turn the light inward. As Joan said so beautifully, when we create the space for it, it emerges naturally. It is there, the lotus in the mud. We simply have to make time to let the mud settle. We have to realize that it might be more important right now to talk with someone that I work with rather than checking my email for the 1,000th time. And yet, while it's up to us, we are not alone. We are supported in our life. By the 72 labors, including the migrant worker who picked the blueberries, and the morning server putting out the fruit. This body that wakes up each morning and takes another breath. I'd like to read two more sections of the Vimalakirti Sutra. In chapter 11, Vimalakirti gathers up the whole great assembly of people along with their lion seats, places them in the palm of his right hand, and journeys with them to visit the Buddha. Ananda asks the Buddha about the marvelous fragrance that is more wonderful than any fragrance he has ever known. The Buddha explains this fragrance emanates from the pores of all those present, and that it is caused by the rice that was left over from the Buddha's meal. For the 7 days before it is completely digested, this fragrance will be emitted from their pores. Ananda says, I have never heard of such a thing, world-honored one, to think that this fragrant rice can be used to do the Buddha's work. So that's the fun part. The Buddha then goes on to say, just so, Ananda, just so. And there are some Buddha lands where the radiant light of the Buddha is used to do the Buddha's work. Some where the bodhisattvas are used to do the Buddha's work. Some where phantom beings conjured up by the Buddha are used for the Buddha's work. Some where the Buddha's garments or bedding are used for the Buddha's work. There are lands where similes such as dreams, phantoms, reflections, echoes, images in a mirror, the moon in the water, do the Buddha's work. Now, I love the part about the sweet-smelling fragrance emitted by those who have heard the Buddha's teaching. That's just wacko. It's just wonderful. But I find the other examples even more powerful. There is no place that we are not supported. There is no place that we cannot take refuge. In a Christian tradition, I might say God is always with us. And the last section that I'll read is one that really hit home for me. It's also from chapter 11. But if you flip through the Vimalakirti Sutra, you'll find the same message stated over and over again. It's a pretty radical idea, but it's very easy to miss it. Ananda, there is a gate known as the Four Devils and the 84,000 earthly desires. Living beings are wearied and belabored by these devils and desires, but the Buddhas use this as a method to do the Buddha's work. Bodhisattvas who have entered this gate, when they see the Buddha lands replete with all manner of purity and beauty, will not for that reason feel delight or longing or elation. And when they see Buddha lands with all sorts of impurities, they will not feel sad or vexed or downcast. They will merely regard the Buddhas with renewed purity of mind. The three poisons are also the three gates. Our everyday life, with all of its challenges, is the place where we realize ourselves. We have habits, doubts, insecurity, greed, anger, and delusion. They are the stuff we work with. They give us our opportunity to wake up. We have a night and a day left in this session. Don't waste it. Realize for yourself the great sutra that is your own life. Wake up.